Hi, you guys. Okay. As the brilliant German philosopher Friedrich Hegel once wrote in his 1807 treatise, The Phenomenon... Just kidding! I wouldn't do that to you guys. Okay. As the New York Times blurb on the front of Jernigan says, David Gates created one of literature's most memorable anti-heroes. As my grandpa said, upon reading that blurb, sounds like a fancy way of saying scoundrel. I have to agree. Scoundrels are the stars of David's writing. It kind of makes you wonder, how does he know so much about scoundrels? He told me the other night at the Union that he has never been divorced and he doesn't drink, so. We all know that David is a brilliant writer and a cool guy. I had a lot of jokes planned about how cool he is, but in true David Gates style, I cut most of them. The one I kept was that David Gates is the only guy hanging out at the press box that might tell you he hung out with Bob Dylan a few times and be telling the truth. This is my last week in the MFA program, so I wanted to talk for a second about David, the teacher. He told me once that teaching writing is the only thing he knows how to do. Clearly, this isn't true, since we have Jernigan and Preston Falls and the Wonders of the Invisible World and numerous stories and essays published in places like Esquire, Plowshares, and the Paris Review. Also, did you know he's in a band? I don't know what David is going to read tonight, but he told our techniques class recently that he's been agonizing over whether one of his characters should say, oh, or oh well, or yeah well, or oh well yeah, or oh well yeah, or oh well yeah, or oh well yeah. I'm on tenterhooks. But if you're lucky, you too might have David Gates as a teacher, and you might write something that he will bring the same intense level of scrutiny to. In fact, he might take your story and read and scrutinize each sentence, each word, out loud to the entire class. What fun. I remember my first workshop with David. You don't forget when David Gates opens up your workshop by leafing through your story and asking, quite seriously, do I have the right ending? I feel like I'm missing a few pages. And you have to answer, no, yeah, that's the ending. The other day, Mary Harrington said that David is the teacher who is most in her head while she's writing. How true. I'll be writing, and I can hear David saying, oh, there's another shitty adverb. Or, really? He shrugged? My characters certainly never smile anymore. Lest I hear David say, oh no, the town has come down with smileitis. David is generous with his attention. He goes inside the writing and looks out from it. This might sound crazy, but it is a gift to have David Gates in your head while you're writing. You show yourself no mercy. You put in the work to get to hear David say, that's a great line, even if he's only saying it in your head. Join me in welcoming David Gates.
Sean, doesn't shitty adverb go without saying? I mean, do you need shitty in that phrase? Well, thank you to Beth and BJ, and no thanks whatsoever to the Top Hat. Thanks to the Union Club. And BJ was really a kick to hear you, and it's great to be reading with you, and fuck you for setting the bar high. I've been pissing and moaning to people about this story and claiming that it had been knocking around for 15 years. And when I printed it out finally today, I found a little timestamp at the top that said it's only 10 years old. So, don't have a title. I'm not going to read you all of it because it's hellishly long. This is, maybe the first little less than half of it. What do you need to know? I mean, for those of you who are not as old as me, are there any? No. All you really probably, you don't even need to know this, but I'll tell you anyway. Alfred Hitchcock was famous for saying, actors are cattle. Have you all heard this? Okay, yeah, okay, you've been there, done that. Jean Tierney was a fabulously beautiful actress who was the star of the film Laura, an actress, so when you hear the name Jean, it won't confuse you. And I'm a huge fan of 1930s screwball comedies, and a critic named Stanley Cavell coined the phrase about them that they're comedies of remarriage, and he's alluded to briefly here, and I think that's probably all you need to know. Would help if you'd watched The Maltese Falcon, but no time. I think I'm reading, what am I reading? Three sections of this, and I'll just kind of indicate where they are. Every Christmas Eve, my father used to drive us down to Uncle Wayne and Aunt Phyllis's house, a two-bedroom box in a subdivision backed against the Connecticut Turnpike. They didn't have kids, but they always tethered an inflatable snowman in the yard. Their living room, with twin plaid recliners, velour couch, and a braided rug, smelled of cigarettes and their fat cocker spaniel. I remember asking my mother, as we were loading gifts into the trunk for them and Grandpa Davenport, how come we always had to go there? I know, she said, but it's only once a year. Be thankful you're not the Christ child. She nodded at the creche on our Catholic neighbor's lawn and pretended to file her nails. What a dump. Yet here I was, 43, divorced, and living in Wayne's house. He'd had to put Phyllis in a nursing home. She no longer recognized him or knew her own name. And he'd driven to Arizona in pursuit of a brassy-haired widow he'd met at Mohegan Sun. Just paid the lights and the cable and we're good, he told me. Somebody might as well be in there. So spoke the voice of Christian charity. Surely, I emailed my mother, an unseen hand is at work. She wrote back, God is not mocked, followed by a frowny face. They get longer. I'd revisited Connecticut just once after going off to grad school to stand with my mother and Wayne. Phyllis was already a liability in public, at the Veterans Cemetery in Middletown. My mother sold the house in West Hartford, bought a condo in Santa Barbara, and told me she wanted her ashes scattered in the Pacific, better to end up among the sharks and the oil slicks than among the military. I was still finishing my thesis, Cattle Are Actors, Archetype and Artifice in Red River. Thank you. See, doesn't the setup help? When Sarah came to Berkeley as an assistant professor. Maybe her colleagues in the English department read our romance not as an academic scandal, but as a critique of gender and power relations. At any rate, a few of them came to our wedding when she was already pregnant with Seth. We had a cottage in Oakland with the old Sears Roebuck gingerbread, where we left the bedroom window open to let in the scent of eucalyptus. What they say about how you stop jonesing for each other after a while, not true. When Seth was 8, I started taking him to A's games, and nobody gave us shit for not standing during the national anthem. I hadn't been able to find a job here. Who in the Bay Area didn't want to teach film? But I made some money copy editing, and I reviewed movies for a free weekly in a column I called Be Generous, Mr. Spade. My takedown of Titanic got more letters than any other piece in 1997. But when Sarah got an offer from Yale, what could I say? They even sweetened the deal with a job of sorts for me, teaching composition alongside the TAs, and the weekly wanted me to keep sending in my column. Like the good sport I'd hoped to be back then, I amused our acquaintances with the theory that New Haven wasn't part of Connecticut, really, but a free city like Danzig or Trieste. No, better, West Berlin, way in the middle of East Germany. A realtor showed us a turreted stone palazzo on the edge of what might eventually become a safe neighborhood, where we could live like New York Review of Books dissidents under house arrest. But Sarah had seen enough smashed car windows in Oakland, and those genteel towns up the shoreline called out to her. The Congregational churches, the white clapboard colonials with 8/8 windows, the maple trees, and God help us, the occasional American flag. Besides, cue the screechy shower music, Seth was starting high school. She found us a federal house in Guilford, only a couple of exits from where Wayne still lived in Clinton, with foot-wide honey-colored floorboards. Just promise me we'll never own a Volvo, I said, and we never did. See below. So how long would you give it? I handed my freshmen bad grades, and they handed me bad evaluations, much as the daughters of Eve bruised the serpent's head while he bruised their heels. I quit my column soon after writing a last tango tribute when Maria Schneider died. I'd overheard Sarah at a party telling one of her new colleagues that it was, quote, a wonderful outlet for him. We had her department chair and his partner over, and many drinks into the evening, I'm afraid I went off on a thing about how the money boys had run the fucking school ever since 1600 and something. I'd done my research. When Cotton Mather grabbed his ankles and bent over for old Elihu Yale. When the gents took their leave, Sarah asked me if I'd lost my mind. In fact, I was seeing a shrink by then. You see where this is heading. Picnic Lightning version, T.A. Jean Tierney Overbright. Sarah kept the house and the Saab. I kept my old Subaru, took Seth on alternate weekends, and wrote her a check every month. She could have made sure my job didn't get renewed, but the Jean Tierney episode had given her a taste for the moral high ground, if that's not too pissy to say. Had it not been for Wayne's kindness, pride, fall, I might have stayed at my weekly rates refuge up near the Wilbur Cross until Seth finished high school. And when Wayne came back, but this is a sentence God alone could finish. By this point, you must be wondering about all my God talk, so let's get him covered. My grandfather, a swamp Yankee nobo-daddy who was always roaring, well, by God this, and well, by Jesus that, got religion in his 80s when I was in fourth grade. God must have been laying for him all his life. I remember Thanksgiving dinners when Gramp would rise and freestyle a grace in King James East, his palms heavenward. I'd look over at my mother, who would make her thumb the lower jaw of a nattering mouth. My father never saw these transactions. His eyes were closed, in embarrassment, I first assumed. He was a VP at Pratt & Whitney and paid to stash Gramp in a trailer near Wayne and Phyllis. But something had happened back when he was a colonel in Vietnam the year before I was born, this was all my mother would say. And eventually God got his way with him too, when he was about the age I am now. My mother called it the curse of the Davenports. This was the one thing I couldn't talk about with my shrink, unlike, say, my sexual imaginings, see above, and my issues with women. To his credit, he got the joke when I said my only issue with women had been Seth. But this kindly rationalist wouldn't have understood my God dread, not that it rose to the level of dread. To finish up, I moved into Wayne's house last October. Now it was almost summer again, and still no word of his coming back. From what I could gather, the widow was playing him against a richer, feebler retiree. But even if he crapped out with her, she couldn't be the only hot senior in the Sun Belt. I put the welcome mat, which still read the Davenports, out in the garage, where he had his machine shop, and kept his restored Plymouth Duster under a tarp. Every few weeks, I got the key from its peg in the kitchen, took the cover off the car, and ran it up to Killingworth and back. They go downhill fast, he told me, if you let them sit. I slept on the driver's side of the king-sized bed that took up most of his bedroom, Jean Tierney having long since bestowed the sweets of her unhappiness on another married man. And I kept the photographs of Aunt Phyllis and the Mohegan Sun goddess side by side in the nightstand just as he'd left them. I promised myself not to put them in the drawer until I'd attained his perfect sanity. Sarah would be dropping Seth off for Memorial Day weekend, so Friday afternoon I mowed the lawn before the rain could start, washed dishes that had been sitting in the sink and endured before the holiday lines at Stop and Shop. I'd suggested that we take a road trip to, oh, wherever. Since Seth had his learner's permit, we could split the driving. But he said he'd rather just hang out. Maybe Kendra could come over. I hadn't met the new girlfriend. He'd only told me that she lived in Guilford. I put the groceries away and jammed the plastic bags up the skirt of a knitted old lady hanging next to the refrigerator. One of Phyllis's homemaking touches that I'd kept for the kitschy fun of it, along with the rooster clock and the pegboard with the legend, "All keyed up." As I minced garlic and listened to Marketplace, the sky boomed straight in front of me from the direction of the turnpike. Had it been the promised end, it would have come from the left, the direction of the city. And rain started rattling in the gutters. Usually Sarah dropped Seth at the corner of Bayberry Drive. Walking the rest of the way, he said, made the passage easier. But surely in such a downpour, she'd bring him to the house. I heard a car pull in, and there was the sob, lights on, wipers going. Seth burst in the kitchen door with Sarah behind him, wet hair pasted to her head, man's white shirt pasted to her body. Come in, I said. Let me get you a towel. Don't bother. I just thought you might have that check. Hell, I said. I put it in the mail this morning. You should have it Tuesday. And so she should, if I went out and mailed it tonight. You have time for a drink? I've got to get back, she said. I'm having people over. I thought you'd stopped. Pretty much. He really has, Seth said. Oh, she said, well, everything you know is wrong, and now that's wrong. The wet shirt showed brassiere that showed nipple. I thought we weren't using civilians for cover, I said, so who all is coming over? No one you know. One assumes that, I said. Can't have the riffraff leaving the toilet seat up. Well, she said, you boys have a good time. You see what I was saying about the moral high ground? As she backed out of the driveway, Seth said, you guys need to stop. He sat on the step stool and began taking off his wet running shoes. How come you're listening to this shit? Marketplace was playing We're in the Money, betokening a gladsome day in the stock market. He peeled off a sock and threw it at the radio, like we're supposed to be all happy for the rich people. I just keep it on for company, I said. Does that sound pathetic? He got up and picked the wet sock off the counter. Sorry, I need to work on impulse control. I turned off the radio and tried to appreciate the silence. So you're getting hungry? I'm making pasta a la usual. I guess. Oh, hey, and I got us some movies. I pointed a thumb at the stack of DVDs. I'd put Failsafe in the middle of the pile, but sticking out as if forcing a card. Is there anything that's not black and white? Now, there is a hanging curve, I said. But yes, come to think of it, you'd never seen The Boys from Brazil, right? This was my second choice. Olivier, Gregory Peck, and James Mason, all at their over-the-hill worst. Great, so it's got subtitles. I told you I wouldn't inflict any more of those on you, I said. It's about Nazis. Actually, if you'd rather, the Mets are on in a minute. I'd driven him down for a few games when we first came east. Back then, he was still in his baseball phase. I know I'm being a pain in the ass, okay? Can I just go lay down for a little bit? Are you all right? I said. I'll be fine. I just need to have the passage, you know. I wish I had a picture of what he looked like at that moment. His shaved head, because he said any hairstyle was a style. His crooked nose, broken by a pitch when he was in ninth grade, and which he refused to have fixed because it was part of his life. You're a good person, I said. Why are you saying that? He said. I don't even know what that means. During a rain delay after the first inning, they killed time by giving the scores, and I thought one might amuse Seth. Mariners nothing, Marlins nothing. His class had been reading The Old Man and the Sea. I eased down the hall and stood outside the spare room across from Wayne's bedroom. I'd allowed Seth to tape a poster of the Dalai Lama to the hollow corridor. That bare arm could have used some toning, not that I was beach ready myself. And I heard him in there talking on his cell. Time to break out the gin. Seth's door opened in the top of the eighth, the bathroom door closed, the toilet flushed, and his door closed again. After the post-game show, I still wasn't sleepy, which was why the good Lord made Tylenol PM. I read around in Stanley Cavell under the two ladies' unjudging eyes until gin and antihistamine took me down. When I came to the next morning, Seth's door was still closed, and the Dalai Lama was still giving me that look. I'm all about compassion, but you smell. I made coffee, brought my laptop out to the concrete slab Wayne had poured for a patio, and toweled off a lawn chair. Beyond the concrete, a lumpy patch of grass that used to be Phyllis's garden. Beyond that, a chain-link fence woven with strips of green plastic, then a stand of trees, then the turnpike. What Wayne said about how you stop hearing it after a while, not true. My mother had sent an email at 3 a.m. California time. Are you going up there on Monday? Sorry, I typed. A little slow this morning. Clarify? She answered within a minute. Had she been up all night? Hello, she wrote. Mem day? I can't stand to think of nobody visiting him. I'd never been back to the grave. As far as I knew, neither had she. Seriously, I typed. Do we really think he's been hanging out in his casket all these years? I changed his casket to Middletown, Connecticut. Another minute, no more. Could you just go? At least this might give me something to do with Seth on Monday, though it still left the 2 days in between. Longer range, I'd better see what sort of affair I could get to L.A. Didn't an attack of sentimentality in my mother, of all people, come under the heading of sudden personality change? I knocked on Seth's door so he wouldn't sleep the day away. When he didn't answer, I opened it a crack and saw a girl sitting on his bed, knees up, barefoot with black painted toenails, a book open on her chest. Pretty little round face, a bruise on her neck. Her short skirt let me see too far up her pale thighs. Sorry, I said, so you must be Kendra, she said. Right, Seth told me you might be coming over. I just didn't expect, I'm Seth's dad, I mean, obviously. He went out for his run, she said. Is it okay for me to be here? You're certainly welcome. You just took me by surprise. We tried to be quiet, she said. You look like Seth. Yeah, well, duh. She dog-eared the page, set the book aside, and hugged her knees, from which I intuited, I see this sounds crazy, that she let Seth fuck her. I always thought he looked like his mother, I said. Yeah, but not so much, she said. She doesn't like me. Listen, before he gets back, you know he worries about you, right? He doesn't need to worry, but I'm glad he talks to you. Doesn't he to you? Sorry, that sounded bad. I didn't mean it like you don't communicate. I talk too much. That's a big problem I have. No, I appreciate your saying something, I said. Anyway, it's good to have you here. You don't really know that, she said. But thanks, I like your house. Actually, it's not really. I know, Seth told me. But it just feels like it's a home, you know? Like my aunt's house. I mean, they're real poor and everything. Like, my cousins have to share a bedroom. But it's like everybody's, I don't know, I don't even know what I'm basing that on. She shook her head. You don't have to keep listening to me. Is it okay if I just stay here till he gets back? I was pouring more coffee when Seth came in the kitchen door, his tank top sweated through. I pointed back outside, mindful of Wayne's thin walls, and shut the door behind us. So, I said, I wasn't prepared to find your friend here. When did she arrive on the scene? I don't know, you were asleep. I just told her if things got weird, she could come here, you know, her mom and everything. Let's back up a minute. I don't know anything about your friend. Could you not call her your friend, he said. She has a name. I know, she had to introduce herself. So, drama with the mother. Okay, so her mom's seeing this guy, who's like married, and the guy's wife keeps calling their house, and so last night Kendra picks up the phone and the wife is like, you're gonna die. Like, I know who you are and you're gonna die. So where was her mother? I don't know, I guess with the guy. So I take it the father's not in the picture. Kendra thinks he's in Vermont or something, Seth said. She said not to tell you any of this. Has she tried to reach her mother? Good luck with that, he said. So her mother doesn't know where she is. Did she call the police? Are you kidding? Her mom would hit her. Jesus, I said. Here, can we sit a minute? I took the top step. Seth folded himself down into lotus position on the concrete and turned up his soles. How did she even get here? Yeah, I knew you'd ask that. You didn't take my car keys. I was only over to... Good Christ, I said. You know you can't be driving without an adult. When was this? I don't know, late. And so she slept in your room, I said. I'm surprised we're not all in jail. Yeah, well, it's not like she slept very much. Okay, I said. You realize this isn't cool, right? So what was I supposed to do? Listen, can she just stay here until... Absolutely not. That's fucked up, he said. What about when you didn't have any place to go? Sorry, I said, fuck. How old is she? Is she even 16? She's going to be. Sweet, I said. Well, we're not getting in the middle of this. She needs to keep trying her mother, at least let her know she's safe. You don't get it. He unfolded himself and stood up. Look, she's freaking out. I have to go talk to her. I waited until I heard his door close in the house, walked out into the backyard with my cell, and got Sarah's voicemail. Listen, I hate to interrupt your weekend. Everybody's fine, but call when you get this, okay? We've got sort of a situation here with the girlfriend. And that's where I'm going to leave you hanging.